A former Taliban fighter who tried to persuade men to go to Afghanistan to kill British soldiers has been given 4 life sentences. Munir Farooqi, who's 54 and from Longsight in Manchester, will spend at least 9 years in jail. 2 other men were also jailed at Manchester Crown Court for terrorism offences. DCS Tony Porter from Greater Manchester Police says the threat of extremism is very real.
The very fact that in our community there are people being seduced by Farooqi's ideology means that, yes, it's not just the police that have to be on the guard, but it's actually the mums and dads in those communities, the mosques, the mosque committees, have to be aware of what may be going on.
In sport, England's cricketers must make 235 if they're to win the 3rd one-day international with India. The tourists staged a good recovery at the Oval to reach a total of 234 for 7. And it seems we don't love Big Brother as much as we used to. The celebrity finale was the least watched programme since it launched a decade ago. An average audience of 3 million tuned in to see Paddy Doherty win. That's the latest. I'm Claire Gregory.
BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
Hello Bristol and welcome to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling and with us to review the news this week is Lib Dem councillor for Eastville, Steve Comer. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is along too. After the 6 o'clock news, the British media coverage of the 10th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks has not touched on the factual errors put out by guess who? The British media during the first hours and days after those attacks. Neither has it addressed how the Bush administration supposedly discovered on the same day that Osama bin Laden done it. And how, for example, did CNN and the BBC both announce the collapse of World Trade Center Building 7 25 minutes before it was actually brought down by a controlled demolition? So, hard evidence, many say, that 9/11 was a choreographed public spectacle with the purpose of providing NATO with a pretext to invade Central Asia. The 10th anniversary coverage has also been notable for branding those who point out these sorts of factual errors as conspiracy theorists. Well, we're having none of that, but we will be hearing some more eyewitness evidence that contradicts the official account of events that day and recommending one or two really well-researched and referenced books and architects, firefighters, etc. and websites of other professionals which tell the story of what really happened. And recommending also the best 9/11 authors who you will not be seeing on the BBC. Also, Ulster's first supergrass trial for more than a decade. Martin Summers will fill us in on what it tells us about the troubles. That's in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first at Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows 16 Celsius and some light rain. This weekend, highs up to 20 Celsius, showers and some gusty winds both Saturday and Sunday. Next week, highs again 20 Celsius, wet and windy at the beginning of the week, sunny though towards the end of the week. Next weekend, that's the 17th and 18th of September, highs of 16 Celsius, sunshine and showers. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Well, time to introduce this week's guests. And joining us is Lib Dem councillor for Eastville, Steve Comer. Hi, Steve. Welcome to Drive Time.
Hi, Tony.
Now, first of all, you've been away. Where have you been?
I've been in Prague for a couple of days.
Okay, and what's it like out there then?
Pretty much the same as here, drizzly and cloudy.
Just a holiday?
No, I went out there for a meeting. I'm on a committee with the local government association with the trade unions there, and we're doing some work on a project on violence against staff. And this was the third of 3 seminars, and there'll be a founding statement, and we're looking to see whether there is commonality in terms of this problem across Europe and whether we can get some guidelines to be adopted.
So did you learn much from the Czech Republic?
Yeah, Czech Republic, very interesting, actually. I mean, I said only there a short time. I had a bit of time outside the Congress, and it's interesting to see. There are aspects, it's very historic, Prague. Because of the circumstances of the Second World War, it was largely untouched by the war, partly because the Germans invaded so quickly, and then the citizens of Prague had an uprising, and basically they did a deal where the Germans were allowed safe passage into Germany as long as they didn't destroy the city on their way out. So a lot of the historic bits remain, which is untypical of European cities. But there are some oddities as well. Because they adapted rather quickly to the post-communist era, there are some things that are a bit strange. I mean, it was quite nice. I was shown the balcony where Václav Havel had addressed the crowd after the Velvet Revolution, slightly tainted by the fact that it's now Marks and Spencer's with all the corporate imagery that entails. So, you know, it does actually put in a nutshell that, you know, whilst there were good things, there have been some transitions that perhaps have been a bit difficult as well.
Sounds like the McDonaldization of Eastern Europe, maybe.
Well, I mean, McDonald's seemed to be everywhere, yeah, and there were two or three branches of McDonald's. Interestingly enough, the Museum of Communism, which I visited, was above both a McDonald's and a casino, which I think is quite apt, really.
Now, when you come back home to rather some bad news today, the result of the South Mead by-election. Now, you Lib Dems, you're already only just about clinging on, and as of yesterday, you have one less councillor and Labour have one more.
Yeah, that's right. Not a good result for us. Obviously, South Mead was a seat we won in a very good year. We won by 20 in 2009. I think it was a surprise gain for us at the time, although some of us who were involved with the campaign across Bristol knew it was a possibility. I think it had been a surprise gain. Unfortunately, the councillor elected for that ward became ill, and so we've had to have a by-election. By-elections are quite rare in Bristol because we have elections by third, so therefore 3 years in four. Generally, they tend to coincide with the annual cycle of elections, so you don't really notice them. But as I say, this was a case of illness and a resignation, and it's always very difficult to defend in those circumstances.
But as a litmus test of your strength, your party's strength in the city, it's not good, is it? It looks like maybe that the National Coalition could spell the end for the Lib Dems here in Bristol, and that this is clearly one of the reasons that people have voted out your councillor, is because of the way that the coalition's going at Westminster.
Oh, I think that's right, and there's no doubt in the local elections in May that national issues were the predominant driver. I think the worry I've got looking at this result, where not only did we drop 12.2% on the last time it was contested, which we didn't win, by the way, but in 2010, but the Conservatives have gone up 10.7%, and I think the worry some of us Liberal Democrats have is that, to an extent, we may have detoxed the Tory brand a bit, but toxed ourselves in the process. And some of that, I think, is that the UK as a whole is not used to coalition government, although Scotland and Wales have been. And I think it will take some time.
Nothing to do then with the betrayal that many people see that's happened with the students, where the Lib Dems were promising to look after students and then find that they're going to be saddled with up to £50,000 debt at the end of their courses, and also this whole business with the National Health Service privatisation.
I think with the National Health Service, I think that's more of a positive, because I think we did show at Spring Conference that we wanted changes. There was then a pause for consideration. There'll be another discussion at our autumn conference, I believe, on the National Health Service. And I think, you know, we've managed to change the plans. On the student issue, I don't think it was the issue itself, actually. I think a lot of it was in the presentation, because what you've actually got is a form of graduate tax. But I think the argument for a lot of people is that it appeared like a breach of trust. There were actually two aspects to the famous pledge that was signed prior to the general election. One was to oppose any increase in student fees. The other was to fight for a fairer system. We've got a fairer system than the one that the Labour government left us, but there is an increase in fees that goes with that, albeit one that you can take over a longer period. So I think it's not the substance of the issue itself, it's a perceived betrayal of trust, and I think that is a problem, there's no doubt about that.
Now, historically, parties in your position, which is a pretty enviable position really, holding the balance of power at Westminster between Labour and Conservative, have managed to essentially, sometimes in any way, dictate policy. I mean, you know, that to actually say to each party, you have to do this, and you haven't really managed to do that this time, have you? You've tweaked policy a little bit, but you haven't really been punching the weight that you really should be, and Nick Clegg should be, up in Westminster, because he's in Downing Street, isn't he? He's got his little office next to
Bailey's
Cavern.
He's got his office in Downing Street. I think we have. I mean, if you look at what's been done on the lower paid and taking them out of the tax system, we want to move that to 10,000. We've made the first moves in that direction. But some of the other policies take time to come through. And a lot of the work that Steve Webb is doing, for instance, on the pension side, I think will be very beneficial to a lot of people in the long term.
But pensions are complex. It takes time to bring that in. I think when it comes in, then it'll be seen that, that Steve is the architect. Equally, you know, I hope the government move on the Dilnot report, because we have an impossible situation at the moment where individuals and families who have somebody with Alzheimer's or dementia have this huge care tax that the rest of the population doesn't bear. Now, if the Dilnot report recommendations are accepted, then that will actually change that sort of system dramatically. So I think there are things that could come through. After just over a year, I don't think they're coming through yet.
But if this result last night continues over the next couple of years, I know we haven't got any local elections next year, but there may be other by-elections, and certainly you'll have to face the electorate in 2 years' time, or just under 2 years' time. If this trend is anything to go by that point, actually at that election, you're not going to be in charge of the city anymore, are you?
Well, that's a possibility. I mean, but what I would say is that things move quickly anyway. I mean, I can remember, you know, I go back a bit, unfortunately, and you know, in 1981, when Labour took control of the former Avon County Council, then it looked like, you know, we were on course for a sweeping Labour victory in the general election that followed. 2 years later, Labour had, at that stage, what was its worst result for about 70 years. So, and a manifesto that Roy Hattersley and others dubbed the longest suicide note in history. So things can change dramatically. Harold Wilson once said, a week is a long time in politics. I think with 24-hour media and all that goes with it, and Twitter and Facebook, I think probably 2 days is a long time in politics now.
Now, you won't have read it in the Evening Post, because, of course, the Evening Post has got what you might almost call a fraudulent title, because it's not an evening paper, it's a morning paper. but on Bristol247.com and other Bristol websites, you'll find the results of this election. And I'm joined by Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, who is out walking the streets of Southmead as part of this election campaign. Martin, what do you think of the result last night?
Well, I mean, we're happy to have won, basically. I think what worries me is the turnout is not massive. And I know it's a local election and so on, but one of the things that does depress me on the doorsteps is that, oh, they're all the same, we can't be bothered, we're not voting. And I'm sure Steve will agree with me that that's just not really satisfactory. And there's a whole element of our society that are totally disconnected.
Well, isn't it not the political parties that are actually not satisfactory by not delivering what the voters want? If they're saying that, they're clearly, these political parties, Labour, Lib Dem, Conservative and Green possibly as well, just simply aren't delivering what the voters want to go out and vote for.
Well, indeed. And I think the problem is that the policy, you know, we haven't touched on economic policy yet. I mean, this is the fundamental problem, I think, that some of the good tweaks that were being mentioned here by Steve, it's a good tweak on a ship that's sailing to disaster, because the overall thrust of economic policy is basically failing. The economy's dead in the water. The cuts have yet to truly bite. When they do, we're quite likely to precipitate a crash. And when we've had a crash, we're not going to be talking about tweaking pensions, I can assure you.
Okay, we were also looking at the campaign as it happened. One of the campaign posters, which has been posted up on Bristol 24/7, is the famous Southmead Axeman Returns, the election leaflet with a small print Liberal Democrat credit at the top. Now, Steve, what's going on here? If you look at this poster, it's a big poster saying the famous Southmead Axeman Returns, with a big picture of an axe looking quite threatening, and in tiny print along the top it says the Liberal Democrat Party. Now, this is the sort of thing which just about makes the post, the leaflet, legal, but it's not really moral, is it, to post that through people's doors and to sort of almost hide the fact that it's coming from the Liberal Democrats?
Well, I don't think it's hidden at all, because when you look at the other side of the leaflet, it makes it clear that you know, it's promoting a candidate. You know, I mean, the reality is Peter
it's
Hammond.
Negative, though. It's very negative.
It is a negative campaign, but one of the problems is that the by-election did get very negative on both sides. I mean, there were Labour leaflets saying things about home care, and they were talking about getting rid of in-house home care. Now, to those of us who live in a world of local government jargon, we know what that means. But to a lot of people on the streets, they thought that meant that elderly people weren't going to have any home care service at all. And so there was a lot of negativity around the campaign, a lot about open spaces. There was allegations that Liberal Democrats were going to close a youth facility, which is, you know, which is simply not based in fact.
But isn't the best thing to do just to rise above that?
is to rise above it.
Well, I think the reality
rather than
is
to bring yourself down to that level.
Well, I think the reality is by-elections get a bit rough. Yeah, we'd like to rise above it, but we know that you know, negative campaigning unfortunately works, and you know, when a flamethrower attacks you, you've got to fight fire with fire. Not particularly edifying, I agree with you, but I think that you know, that's the reality of the game we're in, and it's no good us or any other party being, you know, the holier than thou nicey party, and you just get slaughtered in the process. So I think, yeah, not particularly great. By-elections are a bit tougher than all-round elections, and we saw similar in St George West.
Now, on to economic policy, and George Osborne has urged this week to scrap the 50p tax rate. This is in The Guardian, amongst other places, and I think it was in the Financial Times as well. The Chancellor, George Osborne, is under pressure after a group of economists call for Britain's 50p top rate of income tax to be scrapped at the earliest opportunity to boost growth amidst fresh concerns that the UK is slipping towards a double-dip recession. Now, Martin, can you first of all explain what is the 50p top rate of income tax? I suppose that's just for the very highest earners.
It's for those on about over 100,000 a year, I believe. And it was brought in as part of the emergency measures by the last Labour government and continued by the current government.
So this is tax breaks for bankers? And
well, no, I mean, basically the top rate of tax was 40%, and it was raised to 50% during the crisis a few years ago. And what George Osborne and this bevy of economists are pushing for is that at some point, when, you know, it's a wish, basically, they're wishing that it will be removed, and they've definitely flagged it up as an aspiration. Incidentally, that gives clear red water between the Labour front bench and the coalition, because as far as we're concerned, that tax band is there to stay.
Well, one of the authors of the FT letter said many hedge funds have already moved to Switzerland and urged the government to act as soon as possible, because this is basically saying that these high earners are now just moving out the country because
well,
of the tax
rate. Let's talk Turkey. The fact of the matter is that the banks are bankrupt. They've been bankrupt since 2008. They've been kept on life support by taxpayer funding. Now, in actual fact, they are going to go bankrupt because they're sitting on such a lot of junk debt that their accounting is Enron-style accounting. Now, in other words, there's no real profits there at all if you actually look into it properly. And this is one of the problems when we had Don Foster on the other week talking about splitting casino banking and retail banking. And, of course, I agree with that, but the problem with that is it's stable door, horse, bolted. They were allowed to mix them all up years ago, and we've now got a hell of a mess, and any attempt to regulate the banks will basically bankrupt them. And so we're not really talking about regulating private banks anymore. We're talking about managing the final demise of the private banking system, and then we will have to think of something else to do. But of course, what's going to happen is we're going to have a catastrophic collapse of the private banking system, and then of course the government's economic policy will be completely blown out of the water. The deficit will increase, not decrease, and then we will see where we're going. Now, the Labour front bench have got to be very nimble in dealing with this. They can't just stick to the, oh well, we'd like to cut but not so fast. Once you've had a banking crash, you're not talking about cuts at all. You're talking about massive redistribution of wealth. Now, this is not massive this is massive redistribution of wealth that's being suggested by these right-wing economists, redistribution of wealth from the poor to the rich. And in fact, that is not going to work. It never did work. And it was the great liberal economist J.M. Keynes in the 1930s who pointed out the idiocy of this kind of policy.
So, Steve, this is a 20-strong group of high-profile business experts, and that was in Wednesday's Financial Times. Which side of this are you on? Are you with them?
No, I'm not. I think, for once, I'm in agreement with Martin. I always supported the 50% tax for over 150,000. We had a top rate of tax under Margaret Thatcher of 60%.
But it doesn't really incentivise people to earn a lot of money if they know that's all going to go in tax.
Well, it's not
half of it.
Well,
anyway,
it's not all going to go in tax, is it? Because
no.
Tax is a banded system. So you pay. 20% on the first X and then 40% on the rest, and once you get to 150,000, that 40% goes to 50%. I don't think that's too much to ask. I don't think that's a problem given where we are with public finances at the moment. I think that's a reasonable request, and if one or two people you know, want to go and move to Switzerland, then that's fine. The high earners have always done that, but we're not in the sort of days where when, you know, people like the Rolling Stones moved to avoid 19 and 6 and the pound tax rates. We're not at that level. I think the 50% is reasonable whilst we've got the economic crisis. If things improve in years to come, then provided we've taken large numbers of people at the bottom end of the income bracket out of tax, then I'm not averse to having a look at this. But to me, I'd want to make sure that we get to a stage where people earning 10 or 12,000 a year aren't paying tax at all before I'm even prepared to look at this one.
Now, the Chancellor, who's your man, really, the Coalition's chief in the Treasury, used his speech at Lloyd's of London to assert his intention to stand by his tough fiscal plan for the country. It is the rock of stability upon which any sustainable recovery depends, and we will hold to it, he said.
Well, he's not my man, he's a Conservative, and we're in a coalition, we've not merged. I think when you look across Europe, I mean, it's clear that you know, the pound is considered something of a safe haven currency. There's advantages and disadvantages of that. And I think we are seen as being serious about tackling the deficit problem. But within that parameter, there's a lot of detail. And, you know, there's a lot of detail that George Osborne would come out with that I wouldn't agree with. He is, you know, a right-of-centre finance minister.
Well, that former Chancellor, Alistair Darling, has been strutting around this week. And he was the Labour Chancellor in the last government. And here he is with Jeremy Paxman asking him some questions on Newsnight earlier this week.
If you were still in number 11 Downing Street, what would you do now?
Two things. In our own economy, I think the government, by going so fast in its deficit reduction, is really strangling the recovery, and I'm now worried that we're simply going to bump along the bottom.
So you would ease off on the austerity measures?
I wouldn't have embarked on their policy in the first place. Right. There's a judgment here. If you don't do anything, you're clearly in deep trouble. If you go too fast, you stall the entire thing, you don't get your growth. And George Osborne's already had to announce he's going to borrow more as a result of what's happened. I think the second thing that is absolutely critical, the G20, the largest economies in the world, need to discuss together how they can ensure that, yes, you get your borrowing down, but you also get growth back into the economy. And that is an acute problem in Europe. It is also a problem in America.
That was former Chancellor Alistair Darling speaking on Newsnight earlier this week. Now, Steve Comer from the Lib Dems here in Bristol, it seems that, you know, broadly you're agreeing with Martin and Labour and Alistair Darling, and yet you're in coalition with the Conservatives. So why are we doing what the Conservatives want rather than what Labour and the Lib Dems seem to want, which is to go slower with the cuts?
Well, I think, as you say, we are in a coalition, and I think the wise words of Vince Cable are quite interesting in this. We have to do something about the deficit. I mean, that is just getting to a stage that of every £4 of public expenditure, a pound of it is borrowed, and that's clearly unsustainable in the long term. I mean, I agree with Keynes that there are times when you go for a deficit budget in order to stimulate, and so I think that is a problem, and Darling is right, and that the G20 probably needs to be a bit more united than they are at the moment, but the reality is that they aren't, and that's causing problems as people in the casino that is international capitalism bet one country against another. So that's a difficulty. But no, I can see that there are way forward from where we are. What I don't see is some of the things. I mean, Alistair Darling said a number of interesting things, but one of the things I've never heard a justification for is that they actually, you know, the Labour government reduced VAT to 15% on a temporary measure. And I don't actually think that had many positive impacts at all, and you know, so I think some of these prescriptions are not helpful when and you know, it cost us billions, and what did it actually mean? A few of us bought plasma TVs a bit cheaper from abroad, so I don't see that actually helped, and I think a lot of their prescriptions were wrong. Having said that, I've got some sympathy with Alistair Darling, because the other thing that's coming out of this was what a dysfunctional personality Gordon Brown was to deal with, and clearly he was in an impossible position of having to try and make decisions as Chancellor, all the while being undermined by his leader.
Well, isn't this the case, Martin, that one of the reasons that Labour lost the last election is because of the fudging that was going on with economic policy at the top, with Darling and Brown actually at loggerheads with each other?
Well, I mean, I think the rot goes deeper than that. If you think about when John Smith set off on the prawn cocktail offensive in the 1990s to talk the City of London into accepting a Labour government, he basically sold the farm. And Brian Gould, who had helped to formulate new Labour strategy in the 80s, said quite simply, if you're going to do that, John, and go and suck up to the City of London, we're all wasting our time and I'm going back to New Zealand. And that's precisely what he did.
But surely a government has got to work with the city. It can't just fight the city.
A Labour government its historical mission of the Labour governments is to discipline the City of London, and we didn't do it, and now we're in a mess because we bottled it.
Okay, on to our next story, and more Britons are facing questions over links to the Utøya killer, Anders Breivik. This is the Norway killer story. The names have emerged from interviews with Breivik and English anti-Muslim blogger Paul Ray, say the Norwegian police. This is in The Guardian. The Norwegian police are saying they are to question several British citizens in their search for the potential accomplices of the mass killer Anders Behring Breivik. And officers in Oslo said the names of individuals in several far-right groups emerged from questioning of British anti-Muslim blogger Paul Ray, as well as further interviews with Breivik. Apparently, Breivik wrote that he attended the founding meeting of the Knights Templar European Military Order in London in 2002, where he met a mentor who used the pseudonym Richard after Richard the Lionheart. He signed the 1,500-page document with an anglicised version of his name and datelined it London 2011. Breivik also repeatedly praised the English Defence League, saying he had 600 EDL supporters as Facebook friends and had spoken with members and leaders. The EDL has condemned the killings and has denied any official contact with Breivik, insisting it is a peaceful, non-racist organisation opposed to extremism. Now, Steve, you on this first. Are you worried that the Norwegian police are over here going around interviewing far-right in Britain?
No, I'm actually quite encouraged by it. I mean, if they found that there is a link with this killer, then, you know, I think we ought to cooperate.
Because originally we were told he was just doing this on his own, and there was no connection, but it's clearly come out in the last couple of weeks through what the Norwegian police have been saying, that there were connections here in Britain.
Yeah, there were, by the sound of it, and, you know, I think we do need to get to the bottom of those. I mean, there is, across Europe, there are a group of these fanatical people who have this worldview that they're on some sort of crusade to preserve Christianity against against the caliphate and all the rest of it, and I think we do need to expose these. You have you know, they're similar to what we had with Timothy McVeigh in America 15 years ago, and yeah, we do need to get to the bottom of this, and we do need to ensure that if there are links, then people are exposed clearly.
Martin, this anti-Muslim blogger Paul Ray apparently was interviewed last week after claims he may have been the mentor mentioned by Breivik in his manifesto posted online shortly before he carried out the killings on the 22nd of July.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, when an incident like this happens, the first thing that crosses... I mean, obviously, one's horrified. It was clearly a political incident. Most of the people killed were young Labour Party activists on their summer camp, so there's a very definite political dimension to this. I mean, Norway is a very well-managed country, in my view. The Labour Party have run it very successfully the last 50 years. You know, their economy is in better shape than ours, although we're all in the same mess. But at the same time, these people are really dangerous, and there's got to be a question of what the linkages are. The far right in Italy in the 1970s and 1980s, they bombed Bologna railway station, they killed 80 odd people. They were being orchestrated by the Western intelligence services, by NATO intelligence. It's all in Daniel Ganser's book. He's an academic from Switzerland, NATO's secret armies. Now, the first thing that crosses my mind with an incident like this, is there more to it than just an individual? Is there a network of far right extremists? And behind that, are the intelligence services implicated? I'm not saying they are, but it's a perfectly reasonable question to ask. The Brabant massacres in the 1980s in Belgium, again, a Belgian parliamentary inquiry uncovered that their own security services, including the British security services, were involved. Now, this is all part of the Gladio network. The assassination of Olaf Palme in Sweden was also potentially... Prime Minister of Sweden, and he was assassinated, and there's the suspicion that again was NATO intelligence because they didn't like Palme's international politics. Now, I'm not saying that this is definitely what's happening here, but that's one of the questions that arises in my mind, and I hope the Norwegian police will follow the trail wherever it leads and arrest whoever they need to arrest.
I mean, the difficulty with the Gladio networks, I mean, they were also known as... Gladio was the Italian version. They were known as stay-behind networks. Yeah. The idea was that if communism took over liberal democracies, and a group of people would form a terrorist war behind them. Now, the difficulty is, once you sort of arm people and train them, you're never too sure where they're going to go with that after the event. And certainly there's implications behind the Bologna train bombing in 1980. There was definite links between Fiore, who did that, who spent some time over in the UK, and he had links with the with the British far right. Equally in Turkey is quite interesting now, because you've got the Ergenekon trials with the army and implications. So yeah, I mean this does go deeply, and we it may come out that someone's got an each way bet on some of these organizations, but certainly, you know, as we've seen, the terrible attack on civilians. I mean, one thing about Norway, just as a bit of an aside, but I think it's interesting given that Martin is an economist. I mean, one thing I do admire the Norwegians for is that whether they've had Labour governments or right of centre governments, with North Sea Oil, they've established a principle that this is an investment fund for future generations of the country, and they very much did that as a separate entity. And I was talking to somebody from Denmark a couple of days ago. Denmark didn't do it, neither did the UK. Mm-hmm. And Norway's quite unique in that they did actually look at this as an investment for the future. Dubai has to some extent as well, but they've gone down the consumerist road. And I think long term, actually, Norway's probably going to be a success.
Well, I mean, one of the interesting things about the Norwegian approach to North Sea Oil is, A, they had a state-run oil industry, which took them longer to get off the ground, because they didn't know anything about it, so they had to train themselves up. But, of course, because they had political stability, there was no rush to get oil on stream quickly to make a political... I mean, basically, the Labour Party decided to bring in the American oil majors because they wanted to bring it on stream quickly to bribe the electorate in 1979. And of course, in Norway, that's not an issue, because there's a stable setup, and people just think, "Well, we've got this oil there. We're only going to take it out once, so let's take our time." The other thing about their sovereign wealth fund is they're not allowed to invest inside Norway, because in that way you avoid what's called the Dutch disease, where your currency appreciates because you become an oil currency. And what happens then is you get a lot of money from the oil, but your manufacturing industry is priced out of international markets. So the sovereign wealth fund in Norway cannot invest inside Norway, it has to invest abroad. So in this way, it protects the currency from being overvalued. Now, this is all very smart stuff. And when I look at the mismanagement of the British economy over the last 30 years, it makes me want to tear my hair out in despair, if I had any. And you can't see that I haven't out there in Radio Land, but I know.
Now, also, this week on the Today programme, John Humphreys, a presenter there, pinned down a guy called Tommy Robinson, who's one of the leaders and founders of the English Defence League here in Britain, as part of their 10th anniversary of the September 11th attack. So let's have a listen to that.
Set up and run by a Luton businessman, Tommy Robinson, the EDL has been remarkably successful in a very short time at getting people around the country to come out onto the streets to protest against what they see as a growing threat from Islam.
30 years ago in this town, there was 3,000 Muslims and one mosque. If you'd have said to people 30 years ago, in 30 years' time, there'll be 19 mosques, there'll be 30, 40, 50,000 Muslims, they'll be banning the emblem of St George in your school, they'll be opening a prayer centre in the Arndale Centre, they'll be attacking your troops when they're walking home, they'll have stalls set up promoting jihad and extremism every single week in the town. 30 years ago, people would have said, never, that's not going to happen in Luton. Well, it's happened. At the end of the day, Islamic demographics are terrifying. The birth rate and the statistics are terrifying.
So are you just racists?
I'm not racist at all. I completely hate racism. We've defeated Nazism, but yet we're allowing Islamism to flourish because it goes under a banner of a religion.
But aren't you promoting hatred against them?
We don't do anything out of hate, we do it out of love. Love for Christianity, love for our culture, love for my kids' futures.
At the heart of this conflict is obviously fear. But is it fear of Islamic terrorism, another 9/11, or is it something else? Robinson says what his organisation fears is Sharia law.
Now, in 2003, the European Court of Human Rights outlawed Sharia law in Europe and said it's incompatible with Western democracy due to their views on homosexuals, their views on women, and their views on infidels. That's all of us. It's incompatible. Won't work. And all we're seeing now is a louder voice and a louder call for Sharia law and aspects of Sharia law to be implemented into the British legal system.
Social fabrics of this society, even the economic, political, are collapsing. And this is where people like myself come along and we present this alternative, which I believe is Islam.
That's exactly what the English Defence League fears, or maybe we should call it the Englishness Defence League.
That was John Humphreys on the Today programme earlier this week. Now, first of all, Steve, you on this. I mean, what they're doing, he's doing there, and I was quite surprised that Humphreys didn't question him on when he was saying that, oh, well, we love them and we're Christians. What do you think think of what are the English Defence League, and how is it, do you think, that they can get away with saying, oh, well, we are just Christians, whereas it seems that they're more like these kind of Knights Templar Crusaders rather than actually embracing the teachings of Christ?
Yes, I think you should have asked him which church he attended and when he last went, actually. That might have been interesting, because I very much doubt if the answer would have been the previous Sunday. I think there is an issue with alternative laws, and I'm hoping at my party conference towards the end of the month there's a fringe meeting by a campaign group called One Law for All. I mean, I am a secularist. I don't believe that religion should play any part in the state, and that we should have one law for all, which is the secular law. Having said that, there are occasions where internal disputes between individuals can be settled by other means, and we've had examples that have run successfully. There's a Jewish court to do with food measures, I think the Beth Din or something, and that seems to work. There is the halal rules on slaughter, and it's made clear that, you know, this is halal meat as opposed to non-halal, and I don't have too much of a problem with that. You know what you're getting, you can make your individual choice. But I do think a lot of it does appear to be cultural racism. I don't think it's Islam as a religion that they don't like. I think it's the people who practice the Islamic religion who predominantly are of brown complexion, and I think that appears to be the motivation for this. I hadn't even heard of the EDL until about 3 or 4 years ago. I was at a football match in Cardiff and saw somebody with English Defence League on his t-shirt. Didn't know what it was, looked it up on Google, and it's clear I think it's designed to bring into right-wing activity people who are not necessarily political, but, you know, have some unease about what's happening. And it, obviously there are links with people like the BNP, but it's seen as it pervades this apolitical image, where clearly it isn't. It's part of the far right.
Martin, do you think this English Defence League, as Steve saying there, is relatively recent? It's got echoes of other groups which have disbanded from years gone by?
Well, yes. I mean, if you think when the English Defence League started in Luton, if you remember, the incident began with the Royal Anglian Regiment marching through Luton, getting the freedom of the city, and a small number of jihadists held up signs saying, you know, go to hell, British soldiers, we want you killed, blah, blah, blah. And then the English Defence League that were then formed in response to that. Now, what I suspect or fear is that both the English Defence League and groups like Al-Majahroon are glove puppets for the creation of social chaos. We saw this in Italy, we were talking about Gladio earlier, we saw this in Italy in the 1970s and 1980s, and as Philip Whitehead, I think, was the journalist, he said, well, the right-wing terrorists were glove puppets and the left-wing terrorists were marionettes. But both sets of terrorists, the Red Brigade and the fascists, Nuclei Marti Proletari, Prima Linea, they were all being manipulated by the intelligence services to create chaos. And in Turkey, that was exactly the same process. So you had right-wing and left-wing terrorists tearing the place apart, and then the army takes over in 1980 in Turkey and says, oh, we've put a stop to all of that. Well, that's easy to do because they were organising it all, and that's what's being uncovered in these trials. Now, have we got, I just put it as a question, have we got in Britain Al-Majahroon and the EDL are our version of this game? Strategy of tension. And Al-Majahroon, of course, and all these other groups, these extremist Muslim groups, which are not in any way representative of the Muslim community at large. Melanie Phillips, the journalist in the Daily Mail, has written a book called Londonistan, and she waxes indignant about the number of jihadis in London. Well, there's a simple reason for that, Melanie. It's because MI6 was the lead agency in Operation Cyclone in the 1980s, where we smashed the Russians out of Afghanistan by using an Islamic International Brigade, now known as Al-Qaeda. And who set that up? MI6. And that's why Al-Majahroon and all these Captain Hook and all the rest of them are in London, because they were invited here by our own intelligence services.
See, I wonder whether there's an element of badge engineering about this. A few years ago, there was an organisation called Combat 18,
yeah,
that used to door bomb wars.
HH. 18 is one H. Heil Hitler, isn't it?
That's right, because AH was the first and eighth letter of the alphabet. And they appeared for a while. Now, there were allegations, and, you know, this caused a lot of hand-wringing, as did the EDL. Now, there were allegations that Combat 18 was actually a honey trap that was set up by the security services in order to attract the sorts of people that would engage in right-wing terrorism and so on, to identify them so that security services knew where they are. So, for instance, David Copeland, the nail bomber, was picked up. Now, it appeared to have been picked up comparatively easily, and you wonder whether, that was because he was C-18 or some similar organisation, and the state knew his name and address.
Yeah.
What's the purpose of this kind of activity then, Martin?
Well, in Italy in the 70s, they called it the Anni di Piombo, the Years of Lead, or the Strategia di Tensione, Strategy of Tension. Basically, the Communist Party in Italy, the PCI, was very strong, and they set fair to win several elections in post-war Italy. But every time they came near to winning an election, suddenly all of this terrorism would break out. And Bologna, of course, was bombed because it was a communist voting city. Most of those people who died were communist voters because it was in Bologna. And in Turkey, it was basically the army. And don't forget that Turkey is well integrated into NATO. Turkish military officers are trained at Sandhurst. They are part of NATO. So the Turkish army was involved in fomenting both right and left-wing terrorism in the country in order to seize power and prevent various social reforms from being carried through and so forth. Now, this, in fact, is standard NATO modus operandi. It's not something that this isn't conspiracy theory. This is all historically documented fact. Parliamentary inquiries in Belgium, Switzerland and Italy have all uncovered this. Basically, the perpetrators, the senior intelligence people concerned, have never been punished. And if you ask me why we've got problems now in the world, it's because those people have never been brought to book, and they need to be.
One of the ironies of that period to me is that certainly by the mid-1970s, the Italian Communist Party had more or less become a pretty moderate social democratic party under Berlinguer, who'd broken with Moscow publicly. And one of the things I find strange is that actually at that time in the Cold War, if you'd really wanted to bring the Cold War to an earlier end, then probably the way to have done it would have been if the Italian Communist Party had come to power in Italy. It couldn't have done so alone. It would have probably been with radicals and Republicans and others in a coalition government. But, odd logic,
but I mean, don't forget that the powers that be have got their own agenda, which is to do with resources, imperialism and all the rest of it, so they can't accept what to you and I would be a quite logical evolution of Western politics, not in their book.
Well, on to our next story, and the children are back at school this week, as were the first edition of Prime Minister's Questions 2, so let's have a listen to that.
You now see the Royal College of GPs, the Royal College of Physicians, the Royal College of Nurses, all supporting our health reforms. You even see Lord Darzai, the former health minister, supporting our health reforms. Labour have got themselves in a position of opposing all reform to the NHS and opposing the extra money into the NHS. That is their position.
Ed Miliband.
Mr. Speaker, I think he's convinced the country he is on another planet from there. He's on another planet. I mean, he actually took time off his holiday, and he had his holidays interrupted. Fair play, Jim. But he took time off his holiday to tell the Western Morning News, and he just repeated it. What did he say? The whole health profession is now on board for what is being done. Mr. Speaker, I have to ask, does he read the newspapers? Because only on Tuesday of this week, the BMA, the Royal College of GPs, and the Royal College of Midwives all rejected his bill, and that was only this week. The truth is, Mr. Speaker, under this government, we are seeing two reckless and needless reorganisations of our public services. Yes. Police numbers down and waiting lists up. Yes. And under Labour, we saw police officers up and waiting lists down. Yes. Why doesn't he do the right thing for the future of our public services and scrap both of these disruptive and dangerous plans? Yes.
Isn't it interesting that he doesn't dare, in six questions, mention the economy? Right, yes.
Yes, that was Prime Minister's Questions from Wednesday this week. And as I said, also, the children are back at school. It does seem, Steve, to be sort of almost getting off on a bad foot there, degenerating into not only not answering the questions, but also for the Prime Minister David Cameron to actually pretend that the whole of the health professionals are behind these reforms in the NHS is simply not true, is it?
No, I think opinions will differ, but I, you know, to be honest, I'm not sure that whether they are or aren't. It's a question of public policy and whether reform is needed. I do think some reform is needed. If the producer interests are for or against, I'm not really terribly interested. I think it's a question of whether we can actually improve the quality of healthcare at a time when we know resources are a problem.
The problem is that it's a top-down reform. If the people who are actually doing the job in the health service aren't into it, then it is a top-down reform, which Cameron specifically promised he wouldn't do before the last general election.
I think that's right. And the difficulty with the health service is the structure of it now is that it can only be a top-down reform because so much of it is you know, it is a delivered on a national basis. And I mean, I look at other European countries when I talk to other political colleagues in Europe, and they've maintained the tradition of local community hospitals and local delivery and local decision making, and we've gradually taken it all away and gone for a very big bureaucratic enterprise. And I think, you know, some of the ideas behind the GP commissioning I can see are sensible. The difficulty is trying to do it so quickly and demolish an edifice and rebuild it, and I do wonder with these sorts of changes whether the actual ideal behind the reform is you know, comes out in reality. But you know, there have been changes, there have been discussions. I think they've been a bit late in the day, and I think what we've got now is better than what we had a few months ago. But I shall be looking with interest at the emergency motion on this to party conference in a few weeks.
And The Guardian, a little while ago, Steve, the ministers, it was in a headline, was the ministers urged to let schools and hospitals fail to hasten reforms. And this was a leaked document, documents obtained by The Guardian under the Freedom of Information Act reveal research by civil servants warning that markets are susceptible to failure and costs could in fact rise unless a true market is created by allowing public services to collapse if they're unsuccessful. Now this is a bit worrying, isn't it? If they're already talking about allowing schools and hospitals to collapse, that giving actually a very good excuse to then change them, reform them.
Yeah, I've always been worried about this whole target culture because, you know, that's the difficulty. The market analogy doesn't work with public services. I mean, if people stop buying things in Woolworths, then, you know, the reality is eventually Woolworths closed and people bought stuff from, you know, somewhere else in the high street.
Poundland, I think it
is. Poundland, Tesco's, Wilkinson's, whatever. But schools and the health service aren't like that, are they? You know, you're not in a consumer game, whereas, you know, if a school is failing for your 10 and 11-year-old and it collapses, then you've got to get them into another school, and they've got to catch up the work that they've done. So I think this shows that actually the market analogy in direct service delivery like health and education doesn't work, and it's a flawed concept.
Martin, ministers have been privately advised to allow schools and hospitals to fail if the government is to succeed in its overhaul of public services.
Well, yeah, I mean, this was leaked, wasn't it? This is basically what's being said in private, presumably to spare the blushes of people like Steve here, because of course he's quite right. Public services shouldn't be treated as a market. I think New Labour encouraged the idea that there was some kind of analogy, and what we've got to do is remind people of why we run it as a national service, because it's actually cheaper and more efficient. A monopsony buyer of things like drugs can actually force the price down if it's properly managed. In fact, we ought to be moving towards things like nationalising the pharmaceutical industry. That's the future. And in actual fact, as we go into the 21st century, we're going to have a mixed economy, but it's going to be maybe 60 to 65% public and only 35% private. We're not going to abolish the private sector, but we're going to put it in its place.
The central problem with the bill, say 18 of Britain's most senior consultants in a letter to The Guardian, this is a health and social care bill, is not the varying degrees of bafflement, unpopularity or downright hostility which it has engendered. It's that it threatens to bring an end to the NHS as an effective and successful public service and instead converts it into a form of competitive market not dissimilar to that operating in the utilities sector, without providing any convincing evidence that such a move will improve health outcomes. Now, do you think that's fair, Steve?
I think we've got to look at health outcomes, and one of the problems with the health service is whenever you start putting figures on things, then people work to the target. It's a bit like Soviet sort of 5-year plan problems. Mm. I mean, one of the difficulties, say, you know, when they reduced waiting lists, then one way of reducing waiting lists is to get people to come off them. They used to have this 4-hour rule on accident and emergency, where once you were seen, you were then classed as admitted. And so I have real worries about the target system in total. You've got to be able to measure things, but I think we need to be looking at outputs and outcomes rather than just measuring how the machine processes people.
On this specific question of targets Steve's talking about there, Martin, in the NHS, this is one of the first things that the coalition government did when they came in, was actually to remove many of the targets.
Well, I don't have a problem with that. I think the NHS, as it was originally conceived, was that it would be led by clinical decisions. And the target, basically, the doctors will be allowed to get on with being doctors, and we will pick up the tab at the end of it. Now, I realise that that can lead to inefficiency.
But as a market is beginning to be set up in things like the health service, you start to get cost cutting, and often people waiting longer.
I mean, the idea that the private sector always does things better, and if you've got a public service, the only way to improve it is to make it more like the private sector, is frankly fatuous. Properly managed public services are not private sector organisations. They're not driven by the same constraints. They shouldn't function under the same kind of structure. They basically ought to be driven by health outcomes, not by speed of how you process people. I mean, whenever you try and put a target like that on, as you say, people work to the target. Do you remember when the police were told that they were going to be marked on by how many people they arrested? And it's like, that is not the role of the police force, to go around arresting people. The job of the police force is to keep the peace. And if you're really lucky, they won't have to arrest anybody. Mm. And the same with the health service. If you're really lucky, you won't have to do any treatments at all because people are healthy. What we've got is an illness service which picks up the pieces. But what we've got to have is the vision. And of course, when you've got a national service which is driven by public good, you can actually have a vision of a health service rather than an illness service.
I mean, I do welcome the fact that public health is going back to local government. I mean, it should never have been taken away from it in 1974. But I mean, sometimes you have to experience these things to come back the other end. And but I think if we can get public health right and health education right, then as Martin said, that means less people going into hospital.
Another story this week, News International is to sell the Wapping site. This is on Monday. News International, British newspaper wing of Rupert Murdoch's global media empire, said on Monday it is to sell its site in Wapping, and if anyone will buy it, in East London, where it's been based for the last 25 years. The move comes 2 months after the firm closed down its market-leading Sunday tabloid, The News of the World, which operated out of Wapping amidst the scandal over the hacking of mobile phone voicemails. News International today announces it's putting its Wapping site up for sale, the company said in a statement. Martin, what are your thoughts about this? Does it look like Rupert Murdoch is giving signs that he may be leaving Britain?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it brings back memories for me, because I remember standing outside this place in the 1980s trying to support the printers that he'd sacked.
So does it bring a twinkle to your eye to see he's now...
Well, I mean, I think it's quite interesting in the widest context, because it looks like basically people are finding it very difficult to make print newspapers pay. Full stop. The Guardian, I understand, is losing millions of pounds all the time, even though it's got a very successful website and so on. I think, basically, print newspaper is dying on the vine, and Murdoch is cutting his losses, basically.
So it's nothing to do with the phone...
hacking
inquiry.
He may have accelerated it,
but the basic problem remains. I mean, and it's not just from News International. I think all... I mean, what you've got is The Telegraph, The Times, The Guardian, which are basically run as hobbies anymore. They're certainly not making any money, any of them. And it's the Scott Trust that keeps The Guardian going. It's the Barclay brothers who use The Telegraph as their mouthpiece. And, of course, News International is Rupert's voice on earth. And what these big media barons do is they run, prestigious newspapers like The Times as a way of influencing elite opinion in favour of things that they want. Because they mostly make their money on things like property deals and so on. So they need nice loose laws about property deals, and that of course is and of course nice low taxes, so the economists will all write in The Times saying yes, let's have nice low taxes.
And of course the other thing that's made a difference across the piece, I mean, you mentioned Bristol 24/7 earlier, Tony, in this context, that has actually now matured as an outlet, and is able to get information out quicker. It's still I think online papers are still a relatively immature medium, but as more and more people have iPads and the ability to read these things, then I think increasingly that'll be there. And of course, what has killed it to a large extent, particularly locally, is the advertising market. I mean, if you want to, you know, for a long time, local papers in particular were kept afloat by recruitment ads, car ads, and houses for sale. Well, now all of those can be done much more effectively online if you're looking for any of those. And I think, you know, long term, papers will remain a cash cow for a while, and as Martin said, a vanity project in some cases. But I think we are seeing the start of a long decline, and it may be like travel agency that it's going to take a few decades to disappear altogether. But I think I don't know, I 20 and 30 years time, I think print newspapers as we know it will be as rare as milkman.
Well, why is it then that there's so many of these are now giveaway papers? Certainly if you go to London, you get newspapers, actually reasonably quality papers that you used to have to pay for, thrust into your hand.
Well, the marginal cost of giving it away, as opposed to collecting 40 or 50 pence and giving half of that to the newsagent, you know, I mean, but in the big cities, it's volume, isn't it? You go on the tube or the bus in London, there's loads of these things around, people read them.
Yeah. Well, I hate to disappoint you, but the company's stable of titles, including The Sun, this is continuing the article, Britain's biggest selling daily tabloid, and respected, some would say, the Times, will be entirely relocated to its neighbouring Thomas More Square base in East London. So it's going to a much smaller place. What do you think, Steve, particularly though, about this phone hacking scandal? Because we seem to be getting, it's going drip by drip every week, more this week, with it looking like James Murdoch is going to have to come and explain himself again. Yeah. He is really the main man. We've also got the strange situation of the Leveson inquiry. The guy who's actually in charge of the inquiry has certainly been to several garden parties at Elizabeth Murdoch's house and has been accepting free business favours from her husband as well. So how do you think this is going to go, and are you happy with this inquiry?
Well, I think there's more to come out, and certainly you've seen what's happened in America with the Murdoch press there. I think there's more to come out over there as well. And with their freedom of information legislation, which is stronger than ours, it will come out. I mean, it never was credible that what the Murdochs and Rebecca Brooks and so on tried to do in the early stage was to say, it wasn't us, it was some minion down the food chain. I mean, I'm sorry, that never works. This was systematic. This was on an almost industrial scale. It wasn't cheap. It had to have been authorised further up the line.
That's right. I understand that in News International's headquarters in New York, there is a secret room full of computers where basically the dirty stuff was done, and you had to have a special clearance to go into it. And of course, what the suspicion is that what they've been running effectively is a private intelligence agency. So they collect loads of dirt on everybody, but not all that dirt is used. Mm. They come to some politicians and say, you wouldn't want your, you know, that's whatever right. scandal to come out, so you will be voting for our B Sky BBib, wouldn't you? That's what the suspicion is.
Okay, on to our next story, final story, I think, and the government ought to lift the ban on TV cameras in court. The ban on TV cameras is being overturned in a bid to improve public understanding of the justice system. So Justice Secretary Ken Clark has announced. They said the decision to allow broadcasters to screen footage from court was part of an unprecedented plan to improve transparency. Steve, what do you think about this? Is that a good idea?
It's an interesting one. I think there is a lot of mystery around the court process, and if this can help to demystify, then it's a good idea. My worry is we end up with a sort of Judge Judy type situation where you know, it's only the edited highlights that come in and the dramatic moments. But I think in principle, you know, I'm in favour of openness, and I would be sympathetic.
Martin, they did this about 10 or 15 years ago, didn't they, in the House of Commons? And do you think it's a comparable
thing? Well, we heard the Prime Minister's Questions Time earlier, and I didn't get the point to make the point, which actually I find Prime Minister's Questions Time extremely irritating. That Yahoo sucks, you're an idiot stuff is
weird. But that's nothing to do with the television.
No, it
was always like that.
It was always like that, and I think but now we've seen it in real life. Can we change it, please? If you look at the German Parliament or somewhere other, some other countries, that's much more sensible kind of debate.
Okay, thanks very much. Now that's time for the news at 6 o'clock. Thanks very much to Lib Dem Councillor for Eastville, Steve Comer. And we'll see you talking 9/11 after the news.
Listen live online at bcfm.org.uk. BCFM News from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 6. 2 days before the 10th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks, authorities have received a threat that Al-Qaeda's plotting to target the US again. Extra security measures are being put in place in New York and Washington, where it's thought car bombs could be used to blow up bridges or tunnels. New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg says the threat's not totally unexpected and they're prepared.
You know, we've been doing an awful lot of this already. A lot of the security that we have, you can't see. It's undercover or it's computers and cameras. But we do everything we can, and we spend $8.5 billion a year in our police department.
I'm a Celebrity contestant Agro Santos has been charged with raping two women. The 22-year-old's accused of attacking one woman in Chichester in West Sussex in May and another in Yeovil in Somerset last September. The rapper denies the charges and will appear at Chichester magistrates on September 19th. Parents of pupils who played truant from school face having their benefits cut. David Cameron says he's asked a government review to look into the measure following last month's riots. The Prime Minister says...